Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce Tasia Scruton. So she's Associate Professor in Philosophy of Religion here at the University of Leeds. So not very far to travel. She's researching on spirituality, religion, and medical interpretations of mental health, and how these interpretations shape people's experience of sustainable mental health. Particularly, she's been working on depression and views of depression as caused by sin or evil spirits, and hence has been regarded as punishment or even as wholly the opportunity for transformation. And this fits in with her broader work on emotions and psychiatry, and with her book on divine impassibility, which was published in 2011, with the title Thinking Through Healing. And thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. And thanks especially to Rich for swapping with me so that I could give the paper this afternoon. Apologies if anyone's here because they thought Rich would be speaking. I've given you basically the entire paper and then I'm going to read it at you. I was really impressed by Sally Haslinger when she came to give the Mangaletsis a few weeks ago in lots of ways. But one thing she did was say, well, I'm going to give you the paper that I'm going to read you, because not everyone is great at verbal processing, and so it puts some people at a disadvantage. And if it's not your first language, it can make a big difference to have it written down. And I think accents as well. So I remember when I had a postdoc in the States, I gave a paper and I kept talking about corollaries. And loads of people thought I was talking about koalaries, and they thought I was talking about koalas. And koalas have nothing to do with my paper, so I think like having the paper in front of you. Also, this is the first draft of a paper that I want to be a good paper, and so I'm hoping more selfishly that you'll give me some feedback and that this might facilitate kind of more thorough feedback. So I'm going to read it. Can only a suffering God help towards a contextual and pragmatic approach to philosophy of religion? In her new book, Toward a Theology of Psychological Disorder, Marcia Webb puts forward passibilism, here the idea that God suffers, as an alternative to negative theologies held by some churches, such as that psychological disorder is the result of sin or selfishness or demonic possession. She writes that a theology of psychological disorder begins with a God who knows our suffering, who knows our distress, and who knows our estrangement. As we acknowledge the reality of both human and divine suffering, perhaps the suffering church, and all those with psychological disorders in her ranks, will know the greater comfort and strength in the embrace of her suffering, God. Webb's claim that a suffering God is helpful to sufferers, or even in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's frequently appropriated words, that only the suffering God can help, is an often expressed sentiment in the context of passibilism. But exactly how a suffering God might help can be understood in several quite different ways. For example, a suffering God might be thought to help in the face of suffering, because as a fellow sufferer who understands, a suffering God provides consolation to sufferers. Or it may be that, by affirming a place for suffering within the life of God, people within faith communities are discouraged from negative, stigmatizing responses to those who suffer. Or again, it may be that passivism provides reassurance to people who wish to affirm that God allows suffering for a greater good, that God is sufficiently qualified to make a call on which goods outweigh which evils, and that this entails that God has experiential knowledge of suffering. In this paper, I want to explore and clarify the first of these options, that as a fellow sufferer who understands, God provides consolation to sufferers. This idea is often expressed and has an intuitive plausibility to it for some, though an intuitive implausibility to others. I'm interested in why people might think a God who is a fellow sufferer who understands is consolatory, who it's consolatory to, and whether it constitutes a good argument for passibilism, or instead play some other role in people's theological commitments or religious beliefs. So my plan is as follows. First, I'll consider some very different intuitions about whether a passible God is consolatory to sufferers. Second, I will sketch some common characteristics of fellow sufferers, whether divine or human, who offer consolation most relevant to the kind of consolation thought by Paschalists to be offered by a suffering God. Third, I'll contend that the consolation offered by God being a fellow sufferer does not per se offer a good argument for Paschalism, but it might nevertheless contribute to the rationality of belief in a suffering God if it's helpful to suffering people. Fourth, I'll argue that whether belief in a suffering God is in fact helpful is going to depend on other factors, including, though not limited to, whether the religious tradition focuses overwhelmingly on the individual's relationship with God, as in Protestant Christianity, or else whether there are significant religious others, such as saints or bodhisattvas, who fulfil the role of fellow sufferers who understand. I'll illustrate this with two examples of other compassionate consolers. The saints, and especially Mary, in Western European Christianity in the late Middle Ages, so anyone coming in from the International Medieval Congress will feel slightly at home. Second, bodhisattvas, and especially Jizo, in Mahayana Buddhism today. These examples suggest that when understood in terms of consolation, it's indeed the case that a compassionate consoler seems to be helpful to people who suffer. And this is reflected by the fact that compassionate consolers are found in different cultures and religious traditions. At the same time, these examples suggest that if understood in absolute terms, it isn't the case that it's only the suffering God who can help. In some other cultures and religious traditions, other figures fulfill this role. The point of my argument is not to argue against the idea of a suffering God by making it out to be a Protestant Christian oddity or something that arises out of a defect in Protestant belief. In fact, I've written elsewhere in defence of Paschalism, but based on reasons other than consolation. Rather, I seek to shed some light on the psychological motivation for Paschalism, which arose out of a particular time and place, and which seems like a religious necessity to some people, but profoundly unattractive to others. As such, my aim is to take a typical philosophy of religion topic, divine passibility, and to consider it in a way that's sensitive to both context and practical concerns, for example, concerning motivations people have for affirming or denying this divine attribute, and thus for how they relate to God. Until the turn of the 20th century, the traditional Christian consensus was that God is incapable of suffering in God's self, but sufferers in the human rather than the divine nature of the person of Jesus. The idea that God suffers in God's self was even considered a heresy, patripassianism or theopassianism. This may come as a surprise to non-theologians, not least because traditional Christian theology also allows people to say God suffers or God dies by virtue of what's called a communication of idioms, according to which the things that can be said of the human Jesus can also be said of God and vice versa, because Jesus being one person, but with both a divine, because of Jesus being one person, but with both a divine and a human nature. So according to the communication of idioms, we can say not only that God suffers or God dies, but also God was born of Mary, God has a beard, the man Jesus created the world, and so on. According to this thought, God does not suffer any more than God, who is incorporeal, has a beard in God's own nature, but only through the human nature of Jesus. God in God's self is impassible and so incapable of suffering, just as God in God's self is incorporeal and so beardless. An analogy has sometimes been made to a CD player. In and of itself, a CD player is incapable of producing sound, but is able to produce sound when hooked up to an amplifier. The CD player in itself remains mute, or in God's case, impassible, but is able to produce sound through the amps, or in God's case, when united with the human nature of in the person of Jesus. Somewhere around the beginning of the 20th century, Christian and especially liberal Protestant theology did something of a U-turn regarding the idea that God suffers in God's self. More and more Christian theologians and religious thinkers began to say that God suffers not only by virtue of the communication of idioms, but in God's self. This quite dramatic shift in Christian theology is often attributed to the rise of suffering, or perhaps the rise of awareness of severe suffering. One aspect of the link between Paschalism and human suffering is the intuition often expressed though barely much developed, that divine suffering is a consolation to sufferers. Philosophers and theologians express radically different intuitions about whether divine suffering is a consolation to sufferers, or rather the reverse. Karl Rahner writes that it does not help me to escape from my mess and mix-up if God is in the same predicament. God is in a true and authentic and consoling sense, that God who does not suffer. What use would that be to me as a consolation in the truest sense of the word? Jürgen Moltmann, otherwise an admirer of Rahner, describes himself as deeply shocked by Rahner's position on this, since he argues, only a God in whose perfect being there is room for pain can comfort us. You feel this kind of real shock and horror by Moltmann, actually, when he's writing about Rahner's work on this. It's not just an academic exercise by any means. This, he explains, is because of the necessity of fellow suffering or empathy or compassion in a consoler. So he says an impassible God is capable of neither love nor feeling. Empathy is impossible for such a God. So such a God is not in a position to console people either. One can only console when one shares another's feelings, and one can only share another's feelings if one has empathy. And having empathy means being passable and not impassable. I cannot imagine an impassable God as a God who consoles in a personal sense. He seems to me to be as cold and hard and unfeeling as cement. Whether we're theists or not, I think it's easy to enter into the conundrum about which Rahner and Moltmann have such differing intuitions. Are we more consoled by a being who is outside suffering and can see beyond our predicament? Or is such a God incapable of offering consolation because entirely lacking in empathy or fellow feeling? The substance of these differing intuitions is echoed by many others. So, for example, impassibilist Richard Creel writes that the look of blissful equanimity on God's face in the midst of our suffering is not a sign of aloof indifference. It's a sign that in the long run, all is well, because all occurs within the parameters of God's power, wisdom, and goodness. And Kenneth Woolcombe thinks that there are strong grounds for saying that the comfort which we receive from God derives from the fact that although he understands, he does not share our pain. If my children suffer, then my wife and I are there to hug them and to assure them of our sympathy, but we do not share their pain. Indeed, the strength of our consolation is due to the fact that we ourselves are not in agony. If we were, we should not be able to comfort them at all. On the other hand, Paul Fides writes that at the most basic level, it is a consolation to those who suffer to know that God suffers too and understands their situation from within. The psychological effect upon a sufferer of being aware of a suffering God who understands his predicament may be below the level of a theological argument, but it may in the end soar on wings far higher than any formal theodicy can. Marcel Sereau agrees that divine fellow suffering is consolatory, but unlike Paul Fides, he does regard it as an argument for passibilism. In the case of severe suffering, one is sometimes better able to console when one feels sympathy, compassion, or fellow feeling. If God is not able to have these feelings, in these cases, he will not be able to give perfect consolation. This is an important reason for holding God to be passable. Francis Barillon, too, expresses the idea that there is something about fellow suffering that is healing. Anyone who does not suffer himself can only half help someone who does. Condescending pity, even when translated in help spontaneous and generous, does not musically touch the soul of the grieved. As this demonstrates, people have radically differing intuitions about whether a suffering God is consoling or the reverse. For those who find a suffering God consoling, an impassible God would be irrelevant and distant in the face of suffering. For the others, what is more consoling is a God who is a guide or help in overcoming suffering, or who can see beyond suffering to the ultimate good. Of course, the passibilists really want this as well. Say, for example, Moltmann emphasises that it's because of God's identification with the God-forsaken that there is ultimate victory for sufferers in Jesus' resurrection, though this is a victory that has yet to be realised in the world.
Solidarity with sufferers through divine suffering tends to be seen as part of a wider story about victory over suffering, the latter of which is shared by Christian Paschalists and Impaschalists alike. Whether a suffering God is consoling or the reverse seems to be a major motivating factor for Paschalism or Impaschalism, regardless of whether, like Thoreau, it's seen as an argument or, like Fides, a psychologically powerful motivating force. But why might one think that a suffering God is consoling? There's a sense in the Paschalism is consoling text that we've looked at that suffering may enable God to be a better consoler by establishing a bond with and the trust of the sufferer. One cannot be consoled by someone who lacks empathy, Moltmann, whereas it's a consolation to know that someone understands one's situation from within, Fides. And fellow suffering touches musically the soul of the grieved, Barillon. This chimes with some non-theological intuitions about consolation. For example, Petrarch writes that no one's solace penetrates a saddened mind more than that of a fellow sufferer, and therefore the most effective words to strengthen the spirits of the bystanders are those which emerge from the actual torments. A few observations may be made following Petrarch's articulation of this phenomenon to help us clarify the nature of consolation typically provided by the fellow sufferer relevant here. First, the consoler's own suffering or vulnerability adds something essential to the consolation. It changes the nature of the consolation being offered. Second, the something that's essential is also infungible. It can't be got through means other than the consoler having themselves suffered. In this respect, it's different from some other ways in which suffering might help someone to be a good consoler. For example, that suffering or having suffered might motivate consolation, give insight that another is suffering, or enable the consoler to know what to do about another's suffering, all of which might be provided in God's case by either goodness or omniscient rather than fellow suffering. So the suffering of the consoler need not be in full state for consolation to take place. The fellow sufferer may console by virtue of remembering their own suffering, provided that this includes being able to recall its affective dimensions. In fact, if the suffering is somewhat in the past, this may offer some advantages. A wounded healer is typically someone who continues to be vulnerable and to have a real understanding of suffering, but not someone who's in the midst of pain to such an extent that they're unable to see beyond their own suffering or respond appropriately and with sound judgment to the suffering of others. A consoler of this kind may also offer a sense that suffering is not the end of the story or be able to point beyond it, while also, on account of their own experience, avoid trivialising or being glib about the sufferer's pain. This kind of consolation is distinct from and offers something different to the comfort offered by sharing precisely the same suffering with another, as, for example, has been argued to be the case with parents grieving over the death of their child, whose shared intimacy may enable them to share the burden of their grief, but who may need the consolation of others in different ways. Fourth, the kind of fellow sufferer consoler being characterised here might experience contemporaneous suffering with, in the form of compassion for the sufferer, but this is best seen as a secondary kind of suffering. The consoler does not experience precisely the same feelings as the sufferer. As Martha Nussbaum argues, if we were to identify with the other such that we experienced their pain as though it were our own pain, it wouldn't be compassion because we would have failed to experience the pain of the other as other. The consolation of the fellow sufferer then is typically given by virtue of the fact that they have experienced suffering in the past and because they experience compassion for, but not precisely identical feelings with, the person who is suffering. Fifth, despite the fact that in compassion we do not experience feelings identical with the sufferer, the compassion of the fellow sufferer and the consolation it gives rise to are often costly to the consoler. For example, whether meditated or automatic, compassion requires revisiting painful memories and expending energy on imaginatively identifying with the other. Consolation requires time and patience and thought about how best to communicate sensitively. Without these, consolation is likely to be glib or insensitive. That compassion is costly is reflected by the fact that pastoral literature or nursing and social work will sometimes talk about protecting people from compassion fatigue, a form of secondary traumatic stress that arises as a result of preoccupation with the suffering of humans and animals for whom the person cares. Finally, we might think that the more effective consolation offered by the fellow sufferer will, at least in some cases, be increased if the suffering is of the same type. Someone who has experienced the suffering of torture, say, may, all other things being equal, be a better consoler to someone who has experienced that than to someone who has experienced a very different kind of suffering. Indeed, this last point is echoed by some of the theologians who regard a possible God as more able to console. So, for example, Francis Young writes that it's often stated that the person who can help a sufferer is someone who has experienced a similar kind of suffering and come through it. The impact of the story that God suffered and died has depended on its implication that God is like such a person, a conviction which has undoubtedly had a profound psychological effect upon suffering believers who have felt that God could understand their predicament. Yet, there are many forms of suffering which Jesus of Nazareth, i.e., in terms of this account, God in Christ, did not experience. Young goes on from this to argue that precisely this fact is the reason that God's suffering on the cross should be interpreted as the classic rather than the sole case of God's presence in the midst of human suffering, such that God should be thought of as passible in God's self and so capable of sharing the sufferings of human beings beside Jesus. The idea that a suffering God is consoling is sometimes put forward as an argument for passibilism, as in the case of Sorel and Young above. But is it a good argument? It might be objected that religious helpfulness does not mean something is true. We cannot shape God in our own image to make God how we would like God to be. On the other hand, perhaps as Sorel suggests, consolation could be an aspect of divine perfection, and so an unconsoling God would not be a truly perfect being. It seems to me, however, that a suffering God providing consolation of sufferers still does not constitute a good argument for passibilism. It's open to the further objection that all that is required is that the relevant people believe God to suffer, not that God really does suffer. Relatedly, a suffering God would only be a consolation to people who believe in God, and more specifically in a suffering God, and more specifically still, who find a suffering God consolatory, rather than to sufferers more generally. Passibilism is sometimes depicted as somehow transforming the experience of suffering quite universally, and as the core emphasis for Christianity's response to the existence of evil. But it is only consoling and transforming for quite a small proportion of the world's sufferers, for whom belief in God and belief in a passable God are live options. For this reason, I suggest that consolation is not, in fact, a good argument for passibilism. While not contributing to an argument for passibilism, consolation may, I think, nevertheless, be a factor contributing to the rationality of belief in a suffering God, if it is indeed helpful to individual sufferers or to faith communities in their responses to suffering. Where evidential reasons for belief are inconclusive in either direction, pragmatic or practical reasons for belief may, I think, provide a tipping point and so justify our belief in one thing rather than the other. The consolatory power of passibilism may be a case in point. Whether it is in fact helpful to hold passibilism, whether one is likely to find a suffering God consoling, is, I suggest, going to depend on other factors. These, I think, might include whether the religious tradition focuses purely on the individual's relationship with God, or whether there are significant religious others, such as saints, perhaps ancestors, or bodhisattvas, who fulfill the need for a fellow sufferer who understands. I will now turn to a couple of examples of these, drawn from pre-Reformation Catholic Christianity and contemporary Japanese Mahayana Buddhism. How am I doing for time? Okay, brilliant. In the early church, the saints were described as invisible friends or intimate friends, and from the 4th century onwards, people turned to saints with increasing explicitness for friendship, inspiration, and protection in this life and beyond the grave. Peter Brown. This close relationship with the saints reached its peak between the 13th to the 16th centuries, with Julian of Norwich describing the saints as kind neighbours and of our knowing. In addition to the fact that people turn generally to saints, individuals or particular groups of people often turn to particular saints whose plights match their own. Eamon Duffy argues that the correspondence between the situation of the devotee and the saints to whom they appealed
was not a recognition of superficial similarity, but arose from a profound feeling of kindred spirit resulting from their shared experience. The power of the saint was no mere arbitrary exercise. Instead, it sprang from the fact that they themselves had shared the sufferings of their clients. One saint who fulfills the role of fellow sufferer in a distinctive way is Christina the Astonishing. I love doing the reading for this. A saint who could both fly and fly locate after her initial death, from which she was resurrected. The funeral after this death was disturbed by the fact that the body stirred in the coffin and rose up like a bird, immediately ascending to the rafters of the church. When the priest demanded she return to ground level, and her friends questioned her about what she saw while dead, she said that she'd been taken to see the souls suffering in purgatory and hell, and then given a choice by God, either to remain with me now, or to return to the body and suffer here, there, the sufferings of an immortal soul in a mortal body, and by these sufferings to deliver all those souls on whom you had compassion in that place of purgatory, and by the example of your suffering and your way of life, to convert living men to me and to turn aside from their sins. And after you have done all these things, to return to me, having accumulated for yourself a reward of such great profit. I answered without hesitation that I wished to return under the terms which had been offered to me. We're told that after her resurrection, Christina lived in the trees after the manner of birds, which may reflect the fact that she was neither fully with God nor willing to be fully in the world. To fulfil her promise to God to take into her own body the torments of those in hell and purgatory, she would throw herself into fires, stand in freezing water, and even hang on the gallows between thieves, and would often scream in agony, though her body showed no signs of suffering. A better known figure, Mary, the mother of Jesus, both held a distinctive place among the saints, and was among the most popular of them. Depictions of Mary of the child Jesus emphasised and invited people to share in the tender relationship between the mother and her child. Thus, for example, the 14th century Franciscan author of the popular Meditations on the Life of Christ interrupts his narrative of the Nativity to address his readers with the following imaginative contemplation. Kiss the beautiful little feet of the infant Jesus who lies in the manger, and beg his mother to offer to let you hold him for a while. Pick him up and hold him in your arms. Gaze on his face and reverently kiss and delight in him. Images of Mary with the crucified Jesus invited the viewer to both ponder Mary and Jesus' suffering. Imaginative contemplation on the crucifixion occurred particularly by meditating on the sufferings of Mary. Mary is crucified in the spirit, and there is a parallel between Christ's suffering on the cross and the Virgin's compassion, based both on imaginative engagement with how a mother would feel at the torture and execution of her son, and the words of Simeon to Mary in Luke's Gospel, that a sword shall pierce your own heart. At times the devotee is invited to participate in Mary's suffering rather than Mary participating in theirs. I think the Stabat Mater is an example of this. But particularly in late medieval European devotion, this is matched by an equal emphasis on the way in which Mary consoles us in relation to our own suffering, for which it provides a basis. Mary is qualified to be a fellow sufferer who understands by virtue of her own suffering. That Mary is seen to be a source of consolation, a fellow sufferer who understands, is shown especially in depictions of Mary in the context of the 14th century bubonic plague, or the Black Death, that swept through Western Europe in the mid-14th century. For example, there were sculptural decorations on tombs, which included the family members kneeling beside Mary as she holds her son on her lap in the Pieta-style pose that originated and was so popular at the time. In addition to the Pieta, another striking and relevant image here is the Mater Miserere Cordiae, or Mother of Mercies, which came in the late 13th century and was common, though not limited, to the context of plague monuments. It's quite distinctive when you've got a picture of it at the back of your draft. Here we have a regal or celestial Mary covering the faithful in her protective cloak or mantle. The title Mother, understood here especially as Our Mother, as well as Mother of Jesus and Mother of God, already indicates a maternal or caring aspect to our relationship with her. And the sense that she is the Mother of Mercies emphasises the consolatory aspect of her care. That these occur particularly in the context of plague monuments suggests that there is a need for a fellow sufferer who understands,
arising from a particular and extreme form of suffering, as in the case of the rise of pastoralism. But Mary's role as the mother of Christ who shared in his sufferings through her compassion means that it was she rather than God and God's self who was the figure seen to provide this consolation. In Mahayana Buddhism, a bodhisattva is someone who is about to cross the threshold into nirvana, but looks back and sees clearly all those left behind who suffer, as she once did. As compassion wells in her heart, she turns back, taking a vow not to merge with the wonder of the great mystery until every single being has also crossed over out of needless suffering and been brought to freedom. Bodhisattvas are thus figures who can see beyond suffering and are liberated from their own suffering, and yet who through compassion choose to remain connected to the world and who are appealed to as helpers and consolers by people undergoing particular difficulties. One poet expresses the commitment of a living bodhisattva. When I see the misery of those in this world, their sadness becomes mine. Oh, that my monk's robe were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world. Nothing makes me more happy than the vow to save everyone. Among the most popular bodhisattvas in Mahayana Buddhism is Kanon, whose name in Japanese means she who hears the cries of the world. Kanon responds to the cries with her 1,000 arms, each of which holds an instrument to aid yet another kind of human suffering. Another bodhisattva, Jizo, the guardian of children and travellers, is often venerated with Kanon, either as a pair or as two of eight. Janchosen Rei, a priest and teacher at a Zen monastery in Oregon, dedicated to Jizo, describes the cult of Jizo in Japan as follows. Jizo, a bodhisattva, is accessible. He can be found out among the activities of everyday life, at country crossroads, beside village paths, and in many small altars on city street corners. In the larger shrines, the offerings include children's clothing and sandals or shoes, because Jizo travels far to comfort those who need his help. Many little baby bibs in gay colours are strung as offerings among the wooden slats of the small Jizo shrines. Plastic toys, infant clothing, baby blankets and tiny sneakers lay at the feet of the statues, placed there in memory of children who have died. Jizo has many different forms. For example, he can be depicted as a warrior who rescues others in difficulty, a Jizo with muddy feet who has been helping in the fields, or a deaf Jizo to whom letters must be written. One popular Jizo is the Mizuko, or water baby Jizo, who is depicted with an infant in his arms and two children at his feet, and who is the guardian of children who died before they were born, or soon after birth. Again, you have a picture, it's the final picture. Unlike other forms of Jizo, Mizuko Jizo is not at all ancient. He seems to have arisen in Japan in the 1960s in response to the large number of women who had abortions after World War II. Today, Mizuko rituals in Japan are popular ways for people, especially women, to grieve for abortions and also miscarriages and infant deaths. Numerous stories attest to the role of Jizo as a helper or consoler who compassionately takes on the burden of the person who suffers, often by taking the sufferer's place. One tells of a boy whose cruel stepmother tries to kill him by throwing a kettle of boiling water at him. The boy is found safe by his father, and in the kettle is found a small wooden statue of Jizo, who is regarded as changing places with the boy. Another tells of a priest who is attacked by robbers wielding swords. When the blade descends, he prays to Jizo for help, and then collapses. He wakes to find his body mysteriously unharmed. When he goes to give thanks to Jizo, he finds the head of the statue on the ground with blood flowing from its neck. Another legend tells of an old woman who lives in a village where the village chief has ordered his people to chop wood. The old woman is too old and ill to complete the task. One morning she wakes to find freshly spilt firewood piled as high as the roof eaves. When she goes to make an offering to Jizo, she finds that the feet of the statue are covered in mud. Jizo has chopped the wood in the night. Jizo's compassion is rendered in practical terms. He not only feels for sufferers, but offers practical help by taking the place of sufferers at his own expense. An ancient legend the Sino-Kawara, or the Riverbank of Sai, relates especially to the fate of young children who die, who are too young to know the difference between right and wrong, and to become enlightened and pass on to the realm of Buddha after death. According to one version of the legend, the children are stuck after death at a lonely riverbed, grieving for the families they have left behind. Because they have died young, they can't fulfill the duty of caring for their aging parents. To make up for this, they must spend every day building piles of stones. But every evening, oni, or demons with horns and fangs, emerge to taunt the children and destroy the piles of stone the children have built. At this point, Jizo, Bodhisattva, appears, and the frightened children take sanctuary under his flowing robes. He consoles them, saying, "There is nothing to be frightened of. From now on, I will be your father and your mother." The oni demand the return of the children, but Jizo stands firm and the demons retreat. Jizo and other bodhisattvas are seen as compassionate beings whose past lives give them insight into suffering and motivates them to remain connected to the world in order to help others become liberated and achieve enlightenment. They are well placed to be compassionate because of their own experience of suffering, and also helpers because they have passed through and can see beyond suffering. In conclusion, in this paper, I've suggested that there's a cross-cultural need or desire for fellow sufferers who understand. This is fulfilled in different religious traditions variously by saints, bodhisattvas, and God, and probably others, drawing on the idea that a fellow sufferer provides more effective consolation. This, I've suggested, helps us to make sense of why the idea that only a suffering God can help arose out of Protestant Christianity, and seems importantly true to some people, and importantly false to others. In so doing, I've tried to do philosophy of religion in a way that takes context seriously, and that also probes beyond formal arguments about what beliefs are rational into people's more practical motivations for believing what they believe. The compassion of the saints and of the bodhisattvas discussed here relates in various ways to the sketch I gave fellow sufferers who offer consolation in section 2. Their compassion and the consolation they can give are shaped by the fact that they themselves have suffered, and they could not offer the same consolation if they had not suffered. And yet, because they are saints or bodhisattvas, their own suffering is not in full spate, and the compassion they feel is of a secondary kind of suffering, rather than identical with the primary sufferer's own suffering. Indeed, part of the consolation they offer involves the fact that they can see beyond suffering and point to the bigger picture. At the same time, their compassion and the consolation they give is costly. As the examples of Christina the Astonishing, of the bodhisattvas who choose not to cross over into nirvana, and the legends in which Jizo takes the place of another, and other examples show, the compassion of a fellow sufferer requires the fellow sufferer to give up the state of bliss they would otherwise experience. Finally, the consolation they offer can be felt, in part, because the consoler has themselves experienced a similar kind of suffering and has experiential knowledge of what a particular kind of suffering is like. Notably, these are also aspects highlighted by passibilists in relation to God. At the beginning of the paper, I mentioned three ways in which passibilism might help sufferers. First, as a consolation. Second, as part of a project to destigmatize suffering, especially certain forms of suffering, in the context of Christian communities. And third, to allay theodicy-related concerns that God is not qualified to allow suffering for a greater good if God does not know what it's like to suffer. In this paper, I've focused on the first of these, but how might this discussion shed light on or relate to some of the other ways? In relation to the second of these, suffering, and especially certain kinds of suffering, being destigmatized by churches by being depicted as part of the divine life, I think it's probably reasonable to assume that this might happen through other exalted, though non-divine figures, such as saints or bodhisattvas, being depicted as fellow sufferers. This seems to some extent true in the case of, say, Mary, though in some contexts Mary can be exalted in such a way so as to exclude certain stigmatized kinds of suffering. For example, that by being immaculately conceived, she was free from the pain of childbirth, which was a punishment given for Adam's sin. It was taught that at school. Therefore, it seems that communities with this destigmatizing in mind
may need to think about how not to exclude certain kinds of suffering in their representations of fellow sufferers, whether humans or divine. The Mizuko Koyo ritual in which Jizo consoles women who have experienced miscarriage and abortion is interesting here, not least because both are often seen as topics not suitable for discussion outside very private contexts, and abortion in particular can carry moral judgment. It's telling that the Mizuko Koyo is controversial, both because of the large amounts of money some, though by no means all, temples charge for it, but also because of the kinds of suffering and grief involved. My discussion speaks much less to the third way in which people might understand divine suffering to be helpful. According to this view, divine suffering is helpful because it enables people to continue to trust God in the face of suffering, as part of the sense that suffering is allowed for some greater good, providing reassurance that God knows what it's like to suffer, and is thus epistemologically well-placed to make a call on whether the greater good, say free will or soul-making, really does warrant the misery of human and non-human animal suffering. This is part of a family of arguments for paschalism from divine omniscience, according to which divine omniscience entails experiential knowledge, which in turn entails emotional states, including suffering. It's not clear that divine, non-divine fellow sufferers, who are not in charge of creating the world, could fulfill that sort of role. Non-divine fellow sufferers, then, are relevant to consolation and to human evaluation of suffering, but not to theodicy-type responses to the problem of evil. Thank you very much.